All right, so today we'll be doing Chapter 1 of The Wretched of the Earth by Frantz Fanon, called Concerning Violence. National liberation, national renaissance, the restoration of nationhood to the people, commonwealth, whatever may be the headings used in the new formulas introduced, decolonization is always a violent phenomenon. At whatever level we study it, relationships between individuals, new names for sports clubs, the human admixture at cocktail parties, in the police, on the directing boards of national or private banks, decolonization is quite simply the replacing of certain species of men by another quote-unquote species of men. Without any period of transition, there is a total, complete, and absolute substitution. It is true that we could equally well stress the rise of a new nation, the setting up of a new state, its diplomatic relations, and its economic and political trends. But we have precisely chosen to speak of that kind of tabula rasa which characterizes, at the outset, all decolonization. Its unusual importance is that it constitutes, from the very first day, the minimum demands of the colonized. To tell the truth, the proof of success lies in a whole social structure being changed from the bottom up. The extraordinary importance of this change is that it is willed, called for, demanded. The need for this change exists in its crude state, impetuous and compelling, in the consciousness and in the lives of the men and women who are colonized. But the possibility of this change is equally experienced in the form of a terrifying future in the consciousness of another quote-unquote species of men and women, the colonizers. Decolonization, which sets out to change the order of the world, is, obviously, a program of complete disorder. But it cannot come as a result of magical practices, nor of a natural shock, nor of a friendly understanding. Decolonization, as we know, is a historical process. That is to say that it cannot be understood, it cannot become intelligible nor clear itself except in the exact measure that we can discern the movements which give it historical form and content. Decolonization is the very meeting of two forces opposed to each other by their very nature, which in fact owe their originality to that sort of substantification which results from, and is nourished by, the situation in the colonies. Their first encounter was marked by violence, and their existence together, that is to say, the exploitation of the native by the settler, was carried on by dint of a great array of bayonets and cannons. The settler and the native are old acquaintances. In fact, the settler is right when he speaks of knowing them well, for it is the settler who has brought the native into existence and who perpetuates his existence. The settler owes the fact of his very existence, that is to say, his property, to the colonial system. Decolonization never takes place unnoticed, for it influences individuals and modifies them fundamentally. It transforms spectators crushed with their inessentiality into privileged actors, with the grandiose glare of history's floodlights upon them. It brings a natural rhythm into existence, introduced by new men, and with it a new language and a new humanity. Decolonization is the veritable creation of new men. But this creation owes nothing of its legitimacy to any supernatural power. The quote-unquote thing which has been colonized becomes man during the same process by which it frees itself. In decolonization, there is therefore the need of a complete calling in question of the colonial situation. If we wish to describe it precisely, we might find it in the well-known words, quote, "The last shall be first and the first shall be last," end quote. Decolonization is the putting into practice of this sentence. That is why, if we try to describe it, all decolonization is successful. The naked truth of decolonization evokes for us the searing bullets and blood-stained knives which emanate from it. For if the last shall be first, this will only come to pass after a murderous and decisive struggle between the two protagonists. That affirmed intention to place the last at the head of things and to make them climb at a pace too quickly, some say, the well-known steps which characterize an organized society can only triumph if we use all means to turn the scale, including, of course, that of violence. You do not turn any society, however primitive it may be, upside down with such a program if you have not decided from the very beginning, that is to say, from the actual formulation of that program, to overcome all the obstacles that you will come across in doing so. The native who decides to put the program into practice and to become its moving force is ready for violence at all times. From birth, it is clear to him that this narrow world strewn with prohibitions can only be called into question by absolute violence. The colonial world is a world divided into compartments. It is probably unnecessary to recall the existence of native quarters and European quarters of schools for the natives and schools for Europeans. In the same way, we need to not recall apartheid in South Africa. Yet, if we examine closely this system of compartments, we will at least be able to reveal the lines of force it implies. This approach to the colonial world, its ordering and its geographical layout, will allow us to mark out the lines on which a decolonized society will be reorganized. The colonial world is a world cut in two. The dividing line, the frontiers, are shown by barracks and police stations. In the colonies, it is the policeman and the soldier who are the official, unsituated go-betweens, the spokesman of the settler and his rule of oppression. In capitalist societies, the educational system, whether lay or clerical, the structure of moral reflexes handed down from father to son, the exemplary honesty of workers who are given a medal after 50 years of good and loyal service, and the affection which springs from harmonious relations and good behavior, all these aesthetic expressions of respect for the established order serve to create around the exploited person an atmosphere of submission and of inhibition, which lightens the task of policing considerably. In the capitalist countries, a multitude of moral teachers, counselors, and bewilderers separate the exploited from those in power. In colonial countries, on the contrary, the policeman and the soldier, by their immediate presence and their frequent and direct action, maintain contact with the native and advise him by means of rifle butts and napalm not to budge. It is obvious here that the agents of the government speak the language of pure force. The intermediary does not lighten the oppression nor seek to hide the domination. He shows them up and puts them into practice with the clear conscience of an upholder of the peace. Yet he is the bringer of violence into the home and into the mind of the native. The zone where the natives live is not complementary to the zone inhabited by the settlers. The two zones are opposed, but not in the service of a higher unity. Obedient to the rules of pure Aristotelian logic, they both follow the principle of reciprocal exclusivity. No conciliation is possible, for of the two terms, one is superfluous. The settler's town is a strong-built town, all made of stone and steel. It is a brightly lit town. The streets are covered with asphalt, and the garbage cans swallow all the leavings unseen, unknown, and hardly thought about. The settler's feet are never visible, except perhaps in the sea. But there, you're never close enough to see them. His feet are protected by strong shoes, although the streets of his town are clean and even, with no holes or stones. The settler's town is a well-fed town, an easy-going town. Its belly is always full of good things. The settler's town is a town of white people, of foreigners. The town belonging to the colonized people, or at least the native town, the Negro village, the Medina, the reservation, is a place of ill fame, people by men of evil repute. They are born there. It matters little where or how. They die there. It matters not where nor how. It is a world without spaciousness. Men live there on top of each other, and their huts are built one on top of the other. The native town is a hungry town, starved of bread, of meat, of shoes, of coal, of light. The native town is a crouching village, a town on its knees, a town wallowing in the mire. It is a town of N-word and dirty Arabs. The look that the native turns on the settler's town is a look of lust, a look of envy. It expresses his dreams of possession, all manner of possession, to sit at the settler's table, to sleep in the settler's bed with his wife if possible. The colonized man is an envious man, and this the settler knows where very well. When their glances meet, he ascertains bitterly, always on the defensive, quote, they want to take our place, end quote. It is true, for there is no native who does not dream at least once a day of setting himself up in the settler's place. This world is divided into compartments. This world cut in two is inhabited by two different species. The originality of the colonial context is that economic reality, inequality, and the immense difference of ways of life never come into mask the human realities. When you examine at close quarters the colonial context, it is evident that what parcels out the world is to begin with the fact of belonging to or not. Belonging to a given race, a given species. In the colonies, the economic substructure is also a superstructure. The cause is the consequence. You are rich because you are white. You are white because you are rich. This is why Marxist analysis should always be slightly stretched every time we have to do with the colonial problem. Everything up to and including the very nature of pre-capitalist society, so well explained by Marx, must here be thought out again. The serf is, in essence, different from the knight, but a reference to divine right is necessary to legitimize this statutory difference. In the colonies, the foreigner coming from another country imposed his rule by means of guns and machines. In defiance of his successful transplantation, in spite of his approach, the settler remains a foreigner. It is neither the act of owning factories, nor estates, nor a bank balance, which distinguishes the governing classes. The governing race is first and foremost those who come from elsewhere, those who are unlike the original inhabitants, the quote-unquote others. The violence which has ruled over the ordering of the colonial world, which has ceaselessly drummed the rhythm for the destruction of the native social forms and broken up without reserve the systems of reference of the economy and the customs of dress and external life, that same violence will be claimed and taken over by the native at the moment when, deciding to embody history in his own person, he surges into the forbidden quarters. To wreck the colonial world is henceforth a mental picture of action which is very clear, very easy to understand, and which may be assumed by each one of the individuals which constitute the colonized people. To break up the colonial world does not mean that after the frontiers have been abolished, lines of communication will be set up between the two zones. The destruction of the colonial world is no more and no less than the abolition of one zone, its burial in the depths of the earth, or its expulsion from the country. The native's challenge to the colonial world is not a rational confrontation of points of view. It is not a treatise on the universal but the untidy affirmation of original idea proponed as an absolute. The colonial world is a Manichaean world. It is not enough for the settler to delimit physically, that is to say, with the help of the army and the police force, the place of the native, to show the totalitarian character of colonial exploitation. The settler paints the native as a sort of quintessence of evil. Native society is not simply described as a society lacking in values. It is not enough for the colonist to affirm that those values have disappeared from, or still better, never existed in the colonial world. The native is declared insensible to ethics. He represents not only the absence of values, but also the negation of his values. He is, let us dare to admit, the enemy of values, and in this sense, he is the absolute evil. He is the corrosive element, destroying all that comes near him. He is the deforming element, disfiguring all that has to do with beauty or morality. He is the depository of maleficent powers, at the unconscious and irretrievable instrument of blind forces. Monsieur Meyer could thus state seriously in the French National Assembly that the Republic must not be prostituted by allowing the Algerian people to become a part of it. All values, in fact, are irrevocably poisoned and diseased as soon as they are allowed to in contact with the colonized race. The customs of the colonized people, their traditions, their myths, above all, their myths, are the very sign of that poverty of spirit, of their constitutional depravity, That is why we must put the DDT, which destroys parasites, the bearer of disease, on the same level as the Christian religion, which wages wars on embryonic heresies and instincts, and on evil as yet unborn. The recession of yellow fever and the advance of evangelization form part of the same balance sheet. But the triumphant communique form the missions are in fact a source of information concerning the implementation of foreign influences on the core of the colonized people. I speak of the Christian religion, and no one need be astonished. The church in the colonies is the white people's church, the foreigner's church. She does not call the native to God's ways, but to the ways of the white man, of the master, of the oppressor. As we know, in this matter many are called, but few are chosen. At times, this mechanism goes to logical conclusion and dehumanizes the native, or, to speak plainly, it turns him into an animal. In fact, the terms the settler uses when he mentions the native are zoological terms. He speaks of the yellow man's reptilian motives, of the stink of the native quarter, of breeding swarms of foulness, of spawn of gesticulations. When the settler speaks to describe the native fully in exact terms, he constantly refers to the bestiary. The European rarely hits on the picturesque style, but the native who knows what is in the mind of the settler guesses at once what he is thinking of. Those hordes of vital statistics, those hysterical masses, those faces barefoot of all humanity, those distended bodies which are like nothing on earth, that mob without beginning or end, those children who seem to belong to nobody, that laziness stretched out in the sun, that vegetative rhythm of life, all this forms part of the colonial vocabulary. General de Gaulle speaks of the quote-unquote yellow multitudes, and François Mirac of the black, brown, and yellow masses, which soon will be unleashed. The native knows all this, and laughs to himself every time he spots an allusion to the animal world in the other words. For he knows that he is not an animal, and it is precisely at the moment he realizes his humanity that he begins to sharpen the weapons with which he will secure its victory. As soon as the native begins to pull on his moorings and cause anxiety to the settler, he is handed over to well-meaning souls who, in cultural congress, point out to him the specificity of and wealth of Western values. But every time Western values are mentioned, they produce in the native a sort of stiffening or muscular lockjaw. During the period of decolonization, the native's reason is appealed to. He is offered definite values. He is told frequently that decolonization need not mean regression, and that he must put his trust in qualities which are well tried, solid, and highly esteemed. But it so happens that when the native hears a speech about Western culture, he pulls out his knife, or at least he makes sure it is within reach. The violence with which the supremacy of white values is affirmed and the aggressiveness which has permeated the victory of these values over the ways of life and of thought of the native mean that, in revenge, the native laughs in mockery when Western values are mentioned in front of him. In the colonial context, the settler only ends his work of breaking in the native when the latter admits loudly and intelligibly the supremacy of the white man's values. In the period of decolonization, the colonized masses mock at these very values, insult them, and vomit them up. This phenomenon is ordinarily masked because during the period of decolonization, certain colonized intellectuals have begun a dialogue with the bourgeoisie of the colonist country. During this phase, the indigenous population is discerned only by an indistinct mass. The few native personalities whom the colonist bourgeois have come to know here and there have not sufficient influence on that immediate discernment to give rise to nuance. On the other hand, during the period of liberation, the colonist bourgeoisie looks feverishly for contacts with the elite, and it is with these elite that the familiar dialogue concerning values is carried on. The colonist bourgeoisie, when it realizes that it is impossible for it to maintain its domination over the colonial countries, decides to carry out a regarded action with the regard to culture, values, techniques, and so on. Now, what we must never forget is that the immense majority of colonized peoples is oblivious to these problems. For a colonized people, the most essential value, because the most concrete, is first and foremost the land which will bring them bread and, above all, dignity. But this dignity has nothing to do with the dignity of the human individual, for that human individual has never heard tell of it. All that the native has seen on his country is that they can freely arrest him, beat him, starve him, and no professor of ethics, no priest has ever come to beaten in his place, nor to share their bread with him. As far as the native is concerned, morality is very concrete. It is the silence of the settler's defiance to break his flaunting violence in a word, to put him out of the picture. The well-known principle that all men are equal will be illustrated in the colonies from the moment that the native claims that he is the equal of the settler. One step more, and he is ready to fight to be more than the settler. In fact, he has already decided to eject him and to take his place. As we see it, it is a whole material and moral universe which is breaking up. The intellectual, for his part, has followed the colonist with regard to the universal abstract, will fight in order that the settler and the native may live together in peace in a new world. But the thing he does not see, precisely because he is permeated by colonialism and all its ways of thinking, is that the settler, from the moment that the colonial context disappears, has no longer any interest in remaining or coexisting. It is not by chance that even before any negotiation between the Algerian and the French governments has taken place, the European minority, which calls itself quote-unquote liberal, has already made its position clear. It demands nothing more nor nothing less than twofold citizenship. By setting themselves apart in an abstract manner, the liberals try to force the settler into taking a very concrete jump into the unknown. Let us admit it, the settler knows perfectly well that no phraseology can be substitute for reality. Thus the native discovers that his life, his breath, his beating heart are the same as those of the settler. He finds out that the settler's skin is not of any more value than a native skin, and it must be said that his discovery shakes the world in a very necessary manner. All the new revolutionary assurance of the native stems from it. For if, in fact, my life is worth as much as the settler's, his glance no longer shrivels me up nor freezes me, and his voice no longer turns me into a stone. I am no longer on tender hooks in his presence. In fact, I don't give a damn for him. Not only does his presence no longer trouble me, but I am already preparing such efficient ambushes for him that soon there will be no way out but of that flight. We have said that the colonial context is characterized by the dichotomy which it imposes upon the whole people. Decolonization unifies that people by the radical decision to remove it from its heterogeneity, and by unifying it on the national, sometimes a racial, basis. We know the fierce words of the Senegalese patriots, referring to the maneuvers of their president, Senghor, quote, "We have demanded that the higher posts should be given to Africans, and now Senghor is Africanizing the Europeans," end quote. That is to say that the native can see clearly and immediately if decolonization has come to pass or not, for his minimum demands are simply that the last shall be first. But the native intellectual brings variants to this petition, and, in fact, he seems to have good reasons. Higher civil servants, technicians, specialists, all seem to be needed. Now, the ordinary native interprets these unfair promotions as so many acts of sabotage, and he is often heard to declare, quote, "It wasn't worth the while, then our becoming independent," ellipses, end quote. In the colonial countries where real struggle for freedom has taken place, where the blood of the people has flowed, and where the length of the period of armed warfare has favored the backward surge of intellectuals toward bases grounded in the people, we can observe a genuine eradication of the superstructure built by these intellectuals from the bourgeois colonist environment. the colonist bourgeoisie, in its narcissistic dialogue, expounded by the members of its universities, had in fact deeply implanted in the minds of the colonized intellectual that the essential qualities remain eternal in spite of all the blunders men may make. The essential qualities of the West, of course. The native intellectual accepted the cognicity of these ideas, and deep down in his brain you could always find a vigilant sentinel ready to defend the Greco-Latin pedestal. Now it so happens that during the struggle for liberation, at the moment that the native intellectual comes into touch with his people, the artificial sentinel is turned into dust. All the Mediterranean values, the triumph of the human individual of clarity and of beauty, becomes lifeless, colorless knick-knacks. All those speeches seemed like collections of dead words. Those values which seem to uplift the soul are revealed as worthless, simply because they have nothing to do with the concrete conflict in which the people is engaged. Individualism is the first to disappear. The native intellectual has learned from his masters that the individual ought to express himself fully. The colonist bourgeoisie had hammered into the native's mind the idea of society of individual where each person shuts himself up in his own subjectivity, and whose only wealth is individual thought. Now the native who has the opportunity to return to the people during the struggle for freedom will discover the falseness of this theory. The very forms of organization of the struggle will suggest to him a different vocabulary. Brother, sister, friend. These are words outlawed by the colonist bourgeoisie, because for them, my brother is my purse, my friend is a part of my scheme for getting on. The native intellectual takes part in a sort of auto de fe in the destruction of all his idols, egoism, recrimination that springs from pride, and the childish stupidity of those who always want to have the last word. Such a colonized intellectual, dusted over by colonial culture, will in the same way discover the substance of village assemblies, the cohesion of people's committees, and the extraordinary fruitlessness of local meetings and groupments. Henceforward, the interests of one will be the interest for all. For in concrete fact, everyone will be discovered by the troops, everyone will be massacred, or everyone will be saved. The motto, quote, look out for yourself, end quote, the atheist method of salvation, is in this context forbidden. Self-criticism has been much talked about of late, but few people realize that it is an African institution. Whether in the Dejmas of Northern Africa or in the meetings of Western Africa, tradition demands that the quarrels which occur in the village should be settled in public. It is communal self-criticism, of course, and with a note of humor, because everyone is relaxed, and because in the last resort we will all want the same things. But the more the intellectual imbibes the atmosphere of the people, the more completely he abandons the habits of calculation, of unwanted silence, of mental reservations, and shakes off the spirit of concealment. And it is true that already at the level we can say that the community triumphs, and that it spreads its own light and its own reason. But it so happens, sometimes, that decolonization occurs in areas which have not been sufficiently shaken by the struggle for liberation, and there may be found those same know-all, smart, willy intellectuals we find intact with them the manners and forms of thought picked up during their association with the colonist bourgeoisie. Spoilt children of yesterday's colonialism and of today's national governments, they organize the loot of whatever national resources exist. Without pity, they use today's national distress as means of getting through the scheming and legal robbery by import-export combines, limited liability companies, gambling on the stock exchange, or unfair promotion. They are insistent in their demands for the nationalization of commerce, that is to say, the reservation of markets and advantageous bargains for nationals only. As far as doctrine is concerned, they proclaim the pressing necessity of nationalizing the robbery of the nation. In this arid phase of national life, the so-called period of austerity, the success of their depredations is swift to call forth the violence and anger of the people. For this same people, poverty-stricken yet independent, comes very quickly to possess a social conscience in the African and international context of today. And this is the petty individualists will quickly learn. In order to assimilate and experience the oppressor's culture, the native has had to leave certain of his intellectual possessions in pawn. These pledges include his adoption of the forms of thought of the colonist bourgeoisie. This is very notable in the ineptitude of the native intellectual to carry on two-sided discussion, for he cannot eliminate himself when confronted with an object or idea. On the other hand, when once he begins to militate among the people, he is struck with wonder and amazement. He is literally disarmed by their good faith and honesty. The danger that will haunt him continually is that of becoming the uncritical mouthpiece of the masses. He becomes a kind of yes-man who nods assent at every word coming from the people, which he interprets as considered judgments. Now the fella, the unemployed man, the starving native, do not lay a claim to the truth. They do not say that they represent the truth, for they are the truth. Objectively, the intellectual behaves in this phase like a common opportunist. In fact, he has not stopped maneuvering. There is never any question of his being either rejected or welcomed by the people. What they ask is simply that all resources should be pooled. The inclusion of the native intellectual in the upward surge of the masses will, in this case, be differentiated by a curious cult of detail. That is not to say that the people are hostile to analysis. On the contrary, they like having things explained to them. They are glad to understand a line of argument, and they like to see where they are going. But at the beginning of his association with the people, the native intellectual overstresses details and thereby comes to forget that the defeat of colonialism is the real object of the struggle. Carried away by the multitudinous aspects of the flight, he tends to concentrate on local tasks performed with enthusiasm, but almost always too solemnly. He fails to see the whole of the movement all the time. He introduces the idea of special disciplines, of specialized functions of departments within the terrible stone crusher, the fierce mixing machine which a popular revolution is. He is occupied in action on a particular front, and it so happens that he loses sight of the unity of the movement. Thus, if a local defeat is inflicted, he may well be drawn into doubt and from thence to despair. The people, on the other hand, take their stand from the start on the broad and inclusive positions of bread and the land. How can we obtain the land and bread to eat? And this obstinate point of view of the masses, which may seem shrunken and limited, is in the end the most worthwhile and most efficient mode of procedure. The problem of truth ought to be considered. In every age, among the people, truth is the property of the national cause. No absolute veridity, no discourse on the purity of the soul can shake it this position. The native replies to the living lie of the colonial situation by an equal falsehood. His dealing with his fellow nationals are open. They are strained and incomprehensible with regard to the settlers. Truth is that which hurries on the breakup of the colonialist regime. It is that which promotes the emergence of the nation. It is all that protects the natives and ruins the foreigners. In this colonialist context, there is no truthful behavior, and the good is quite simply that which is evil for quote-unquote them. Thus we see that the primary Manichaeism which governed colonial society is preserved intact during the period of decolonization. That is to say that the settler never ceases to be the enemy, the opponent, the foe that must be overthrown. The oppressor in his own sphere starts the process, a process of domination, of exploitation, and of pillage. And in the other sphere, the coiled, plundered creature, which is the native, provides fodder for the process as best he can. The process, which moves uninterruptedly from the banks of the colonial territory to the palaces and the docks of the mother country. In this becalmed zone, the sea has a smooth surface, the palm tree stirs gently in the breeze, the wave laps against the pebbles, and raw materials are ceaselessly transported, justifying the presence of the settler. And all the while, the native, bent double, more dead than alive, exists intermediably in an unchanging dream. The settler makes history. His life is an epoch, an odyssey. He is the absolute beginning. Quote, this land was created by us, end quote. He is the unceasing cause. Quote, if we leave, all is lost, and the country will go back to the Middle Ages, end quote. Over against him, torpid creatures wasted by fevers, obsessed by ancestral customs, form an almost inorganic background for the innovating dynamism of colonial mercantilism. The settler makes history and is conscious of making it, and because he constantly refers to the history of his mother country, he clearly indicates that he himself is the extension of that mother country. Thus, the history which he writes is not the history of the country which he plunders, but the history of his own nation in regards to all that she skims off, all that she violates and starves. The immobility to which the native is condemned can only be called in question if the native decides to put an end to the history of colonization, the history of pillage, and to bring into existence the history of the nation, the history of decolonization. A world divided into compartments, a motionless, Machianistic world of statues, the statue of the general who carried out the conquest, the statue of the engineer who built the bridge, a world which is sure of itself, which crushes with its stones the backs flayed by whips. This is the colonial world. The native is a being hemmed in. Apartheid is simply one form of the division into compartments of the colonial world. The first thing which the native learns is to stay in his place and not to go beyond certain limits. This is why the dream of the native are always of muscular prowess. His dreams are of action and aggression. I dream I am jumping, swimming, running, climbing. I dream that I burst out laughing, that I span a river in one stride, or that I am followed by a flood of motor cars which never catch up with me. During the period of decolonization, the native never stops achieving his freedom from 9 in the evening until 6 in the morning. The colonized man will first manifest this aggressiveness, which has been despotted in his bones against his own people. This is the period when the N-words beat each other up, and the police and the magistrates do not know which way to turn when faced with the astonishing waves of the crime in North Africa. We shall see later how this phenomenon should be judged. When the native is confronted with the colonial order of things, he finds he is in a state of permanent tension. The settler's world is a hostile world, which spurns the native, but at the same time, it is a world of which he is envious. We have seen that the native never ceases to dream of putting himself in the place of the settler, not of becoming the settler, but of substituting himself for the settler. This hostile world, ponderous and aggressive because it fends off the colonized masses with all the harshness it is capable of, represents not merely a hell from which the swiftest flight possible is desirable, but also a paradise close at hand which is guarded by terrible watchdogs. The native is always on the alert, for since he can only make out with difficulty the many symbols of the colonial world, he is never sure whether or not he has crossed the frontier. Confronted with a world ruled by the settler, the native is always presumed guilty. But the native's guilt is never a guilt which he accepts. It is rather a kind of curse, a sort of sword of Damocles, for in his innermost spirit, the native admits no accusation. He is overpowered, but not tamed. He is treated as an inferior, but he is not convinced of his inferiority. He is patiently waiting until the settler is off his guard to fly at him. The native's muscles are always tensed. You can't say that he is terrorized or even apprehensive. He is, in fact, at a ready moment notice to exchange the role of the quarry for that of the hunter. The native is an oppressed person whose permanent dream is to become the persecutor. The symbols of social order, the police, the bugle calls in the barracks, military parades, and waving flags are at one and the same time inhibitory and stimulating, for they do not convey the message, quote-unquote, don't dare to budge. Rather, they cry out, quote-unquote, get ready to attack. And in fact, if the native had any tendency to fall asleep and to forget, the settler's hauteur and the settler's anxiety to test the strength of the colonial system would remind him at every turn that the great showdown cannot be put off indefinitely. That impulse to take the settler's place implies the tonicity of muscles the whole time. And in fact, we know that in certain emotional conditions, the presence of an obstacle accentuates the tendency toward motion. The settler-native relationship is a mess relationship. The settler pits brute force against the weight of numbers. He is an exhibitionist. His preoccupation with security makes him remind the native out loud that there he alone is master. The settler keeps alive in the native anger which he deprives of outlet. The native is trapped in the tight links of the chains of colonialism, but we have seen that inwardly the settler can only achieve a pseudo-petrification. The native's muscular tension finds outlet regularly in bloodthirsty explosions, in tribal warfare, in feuds between septs, in quarrels between individuals. Where individuals are concerned, a positive negation of common sense is evident. While the settler or the policeman has the right to the livelong day to strike the native, to insult him, and to make him crawl to them, you will see the native reaching for his knife at the slightest hostile or aggressive glance cast on him by another native, for the last resort of the native is to defend his personality vis-a-vis his brother. Tribal feuds only serve to perpetuate old grudges buried deep in the memory. By throwing himself with all his force into the vendetta, the native tries to persuade himself that colonialism does not exist, that everything is going on as before, that history continues. Here on the level of communal organizations, we clearly discern the well-known behavior patterns of avoidance. It is as if purging into fraternal bloodbath allowed them to ignore the obstacle and put off till later the choice, nevertheless inevitable, which opens up the question of armed resistance to colonialism. Thus, collective auto-destruction is a very concrete form, is one of the ways in which the native's muscular tension is set free. All these patterns of conduct are those of the depth reflex when faced with danger, a suicidal behavior which proves to the settler, whose existence and domination is by them all the more justified, that these men are not reasonable human beings. In the same way, the native manages to bypass the settler. A belief in fatality removes all blame from the oppressor. The cause of misfortunes and poverty is attributed to God. He is fate. In this way, the individual accepts the disintegration ordained by God, bows down before the settler and his lot, and by a kind of interior re-establishization acquires a stony calm. Meanwhile, however, life goes on, and the native will strengthen the inhibitions which contain his aggressionness by drawing on the terrifying myths which are so frequently found in underdeveloped communities. There are maleficent spirits which intervene every time a step is taken in the wrong direction. Leopard men, serpent men, six-legged dogs, zombies, a whole series of tiny animals or giants which create around the native a world of prohibitions, of barriers and inhibitions far more terrifying than the world of the settler. This magical superstructure which permeates native society fulfills certain well-defined functions of the dynamism of the libido. One of the characteristics of underdeveloped societies is, in fact, that the libido is first and foremost the concern of a group, or of the family, the feature of communities whereby a man who dreams that he has a sexual relations with a woman other than his own must confess it in public and pay a fine in kind in working days to the injured husband or family is fully described by ethnologists. We may note in passing that this proves that the so-called prehistoric societies attach great importance to the unconscious. The atmosphere of myth and magic frightens me, and so takes on an undoubted reality. By terrifying me, it integrates me in the traditions and the history of my district or my tribe, and at the same time it reassures me, it gives me a status, as it were an identification paper. In underdeveloped countries, the occult sphere is a sphere belonging to the community which is entirely under magical jurisdiction. By entangling myself in this inextricable network where actions are repeated with crystalline inevitability, I find the everlasting world which belongs to me and the perenniality which is thereby affirmed of the world belonging to us. Believe me, the zombies are more terrifying than the settlers, and in consequence, the problem is no longer of keeping oneself right with the colonial world and its barbed wire entanglements, but of considering three times before urinating, spitting, or going out into the night. The supernatural, magical powers reveal themselves as essentially personal. The settlers' powers are infinitely shrunken, stamped with their alien origin. We no longer really need to fight against them, since what counts is the frightening enemy created by the myths. We perceive that all is settled by a permanent confrontation on the phantasmic plane. It has always happened in the struggle for freedom that such a people formerly lost in an imaginary maze, a prey to unspeakable terrors, yet happy to lose themselves in a dream-like torment. Such a people becomes unhinged, reorganizes itself, and in blood and tears gives birth to very real and immediate action. Feeding the Mujahideens, posting sentinels, coming to the help of families which lack the bare necessities, or taking the place of a husband who has been killed or imprisoned, such are the concrete tasks to which the people is called during the struggle for freedom. In the colonial world, the emotional sensitivity of the native is kept on the surface of his skin, like an open sore which flinches from the caustic agent, and the psyche shrinks back, obliterates itself, and finds outlet in muscular demonstrations, which have caused certain very wise men to say that the native is a hysterical type. This sensitive emotionalism, watched by invisible keepers, who are, however, in unbroken contact with the core of the personality, will find its fulfillment through eroticism in the driving forces behind the crisis's disillusion. On another level, we see the native's emotional sensibility exhausting itself in dances which are more or less ecstatic. This is why any study of the colonial world should take into consideration the phenomena of the dance and of possession. The native's relaxation takes precisely the form of a muscular orgy, in which the most acute aggressivity and the most impelling violence are canalized, transformed, and conjured away. The circle of the dance is a permissive circle. It protects and permits. At certain times, on certain days, men and women come together at a given place, and there, under the solemn eye of the tribe, fling themselves into a seemingly unorganized pantomime, which is in reality extremely systematic, in, by various means, shakes of the head, bending of the spinal column, throwing of the whole body backward, may be deciphered as in an open book the huge effort of a community to exercise itself, to liberate itself, to explain itself. There are no limits inside the circle. The hillock up which you have toiled, as it if to be nearer to the moon, the river bank down which you slip, as if the show to show the connection between the dance and the ablutions, cleansing and purification, these are sacred places. There are no limits, for in reality your purpose in coming together is to allow an accumulated libido and hampered aggressivity to dissolve as in a volcanic eruption. Symbolic killings, fantastic rides, imaginary mass murders, all must be brought out. The evil horrors are undammed and flow away with a din as of a molten lava. One step further and you are completely possessed. In fact, these are actually organized seances of possession and exorcism. They include vampirism, possession by the Djinns, by zombies, and by Legba, the famous god of the voodoo. This disintegration of the personality, this splitting and disillusion, all fulfills a primordial function in the organism of the colonial world. When they set out, the men and women were impatient, stamping their feet in a state of nervous excitement. When they return, peace has been restored to the village. It is once more calm and unmoved. During the struggle for freedom, a marked alienation from these practices is observed. The native's back is to the wall, the knife is at his throat, or more precisely, the electrode at his genitals. He will have no more to call for his fancies. After centuries of unreality, after having wallowed in the most outlandish phantoms, At long last, the native, gun in hand, stands face to face with the only forces which contend for his life, the forces of colonialism, and the youth of the colonized country growing up in an atmosphere of shot and fire may well make a mock of, and does not hesitate to pour scorn upon the zombies of his ancestors, the horses with two heads, the dead who rise again, and the djinns who rush into your body while you yawn. The native discovers reality and transforms it to the pattern of his customs, into the practice of violence, and into his plan for freedom. We have seen that the same violence, though kept very much on the surface all through the colonial period, yet turns in the void. We have seen also that it is canalized by the emotional outlets of dance and possession by spirits. We have seen how it is exhausted in fratricidal combats. Now the problem is to lay hold of this violence which is changing direction. When formerly it was appeased by the myths and exercised its talents in finding fresh ways of committing mass suicide, now new conditions will make it possible a completely new line of action. Nowadays, a theoretical problem of prime importance is being set, on the historical plane as well as on the level of political tactics. By the liberation of the colonies, when can one affirm that the situation is ripe for a movement of national liberation? In what form should it first be manifested? Because the various means whereby decolonization has been carried out have appeared in many different aspects, reason hesitates and refutes to say which is a true decolonization and which is false. We shall see that for a man who is in the thick of the fight, it is an urgent matter to decide on the means and the tactics to employ. That is to say, how to conduct and organize the movement. If this coherence is not present, there is only a blind will toward freedom, with the terribly reactionary risks which it entails. What are the forces which in the colonial period open up new outlets and engender new aims for the violence of colonized people? In the first place, there are the political parties and the intellectual or commercial elites. Now, the characteristic feature of certain political structures is that they proclaim abstract principles but refrain from issuing definite commands. The entire action of these nationalist political parties during the colonial period is action of the electoral type, a string of philosophical political dissertations on themes of the rights of peoples to self-determination, the rights of man to freedom from hunger and human dignity, and the unceasing affirmation of the principle, quote-unquote, one man, one vote. The national political parties never lay stress upon the necessity of a trial of armed strength for the good of reason that their objective is not the radical overthrowing of the system. Pacifists and legalists, they are in fact partisans of the order, the new order. But to the colonist bourgeoisie, they put bluntly enough the demand which to them is the main one, quote-unquote, give us more power. On the specific question of violence, the elite are ambiguous. They are violent in their words and reformist in their attitudes. When the nationalist political leaders say something, they make quite clear that they do not really think it. The characteristic on the part of the nationalist political parties should be interpreted in the light of both the makeup of their leaders and the nature of their followings. The rank and file of a nationalist party is urban. The workers, primary school teachers, artisans, and small shopkeepers who have begun to profit at a discount, to be sure, from the colonial setup have special interests at heart. What this sort of following demands is the betterment of their particular lot. Increased salaries, for example. The dialogue between these political parties and colonialism is never broken off. Improvements are discussed, such as full electoral representation, the liberty of the press, and liberty of association. Reforms are debated. Thus, it need not astonish anyone to notice that a large number of natives are militant members of the branches of political parties which stem from the mother country. These natives fight under abstract watchword, quote-unquote, government by the workers, and they forget that in their country it should be nationalist watchwords which are first in the field. The native intellectual has clothed his aggressiveness in his barely veiled desire to assimilate himself to the colonial world. He has used his aggressiveness to serve his own individual interests. Thus, there is very easily brought into being a kind of class of affranchised slaves, or slaves who are individually free. What the intellectual demands is the right to multiply the emancipated, and the opportunity to organize a genuine class of emancipated citizens. On the other hand, the mass of the people who have no intention of standing by and watching individuals increase their chances of success, what they demand is not the settler's position of status, but the settler's place. The immense majority of natives want the settler's farm. For them, there is no question of entering into competition with the settler. They want to take his place. The peasantry is systematically disregarded for the most part by the propaganda put out by the nationalist parties, and it is clear that in the colonial countries the peasants alone are revolutionary, for they have nothing to lose and everything to gain. The starving peasant outside the class system is the first among the exploited to discover that only violence pays. For him, there is no compromise, no possible coming to terms. Colonization and decolonization are simply a question of relative strength. The exploited man sees that his liberation implies the use of all means, and that of force first and foremost. When in 1956, after the capitulation of Monsieur Guy Mollet to the settlers in Algeria, the Front de Libération Nationale in a famous leaflet stated that colonialism only loosens its hold when the knife is at its throat, no Algerian found these terms too violent. The leaflet only expressed what every Algerian felt at heart. Colonialism is not a thinking machine, nor a body endowed with reasoning facilities. It is violence in its natural state, and it will only yield when confronted with greater violence. At the decisive moment, the colonialist bourgeoisie, which up till then had remained inactive, comes into the field. It introduces that new idea which is in proper parlance a creation of the colonial situation, nonviolence. In its simplest form, this nonviolence signifies to the intellectual and economic elite of the colonized country that the bourgeoisie has the same interests as they, and that it is therefore urgent and indispensable to come to terms for the public good. Nonviolence is an attempt to settle the colonial problem around a green baize table, for any regrettable act has been performed or irreparable gesture made before any blood has been shed. But if the masses, without waiting for the chairs to be arranged around the baize table, listen to their own voice and begin committing outrages and setting fire to buildings, the elite and the nationalist bourgeois parties will be seen rushing to the colonialists to exclaim, "This is very serious. We do not know how it will end. We must find a solution, some sort of compromise." This idea of compromise is very important in the phenomenon of decolonization, for it is very far from being a simple one. Compromise involves the colonial system and the young nationalist bourgeoisie at one and the same time. The partisans of the colonial system discover that the masses may destroy everything. Blown up bridges, ravaged farms, repressions, and fighting harshly disrupt the economy. Compromise is equally attractive to the nationalist bourgeoisie, who, since they are not clearly aware of the possible consequences of the rising storm, are genuinely afraid of being swept away by this huge hurricane and never stop saying to the settlers, quote, "We are still capable of stopping the slaughter. The masses still have confidence in us. Act quickly if you do not want to put everything in jeopardy," end quote. One step more, and the leader of the Nationalist Party keeps his distance with regard to that violence. He loudly proclaims that he has nothing to do with these Mau Mau, these terrorists, these throat slitters. At best, he shuts himself off in a no man's land between these terrorists and the settlers, and willingly offers his services as a go-between. That is to say, that as the settlers cannot discuss terms with these Mau Mau, he himself will be quite willing to begin negotiations. Thus, it is at that rear guard of the national struggle that the very party of people who have never ceased to be on the other side of in the fight find themselves somersaulted into the van of negotiations and compromise precisely because that party has taken very good care never to break contact with colonialism. Before negotiations have been set afoot, the majority of nationalist parties confine themselves for the most part to explaining the excusing of this quote-unquote savagery. They do not assert that the people have to use physical force, and it sometimes even happens that they go so far as to condemn in private the spectacular deeds which are declared to be hateful by the press and public opinion in the mother country. The legitimate excuse for this ultra-conservative policy is the desire to see things in an objective light, but this traditional attitude of the native intellectual and the leaders of the nationalist party is not, in reality, in the least objective. For in fact, they are not at all convinced that this impatient violence of the masses is the most efficient means of defending their own interests. Moreover, there are some individuals who are convinced of the ineffectiveness of violent methods. For them, there is no doubt about it. Every attempt to break colonial oppression by force is a hopeless effort, an attempt at suicide, because in the innermost recess of their brains, the settlers' tanks and airplanes occupy a huge place. When they are told, quote-unquote, action must be taken, they see bombs raining down on them, armored cars coming at them on every path, machine gunning and police action. And they sit quiet. They are beaten from the start. There is no need to demonstrate their incapacity to triumph by violent methods. They take it for granted in their everyday life and in their political maneuvers. They have remained in the same childish position as Engels took up in his most famous polemic with that monument of puerility, Monsieur Düring. Quote, in the same way that Robinson was able to obtain a sword, we can just as well suppose that Friday might appear one fine morning with a loaded revolver in his hand, and from then on, the whole relationship of violence is reversed. Man Friday gives the orders, and Crusoe is obliged to work. Thus, the revolver triumphs over the sword, and even the most childish believer in axioms will doubtless form the conclusion that violence is not a simple act of will, but needs for its realization certain very concrete preliminary conditions, and particular the implements of violence, and the more highly developed of these implements will carry the day against primitive ones. Moreover, the very fact of the ability to produce such weapons signifies that the producer of highly developed weapons in everyday speech, the arms manufacturer, triumphs over the producer of primitive weapons. To put it briefly, the triumph of violence depends upon the production of armaments, and this in its turn depends on production in general, and thus on economic strength, on economy of the state, and in the last resort on the material means which that violence commands. End quote. In fact, the leaders of reform have nothing else to say than, quote, with what are you going to fight the settlers? With your knives? Your shotguns? End quote. It is true that weapons are important when violence comes into play, since all finally depends on the distribution of these implements, but it so happens that the liberation of colonial countries throws new light on the subject. For example, we have seen that during the Spanish campaign, which was a very genuine colonial war, Napoleon, in spite of an army which reached the offensive of spring in 1810, the huge figure of 400,000 men was forced to retreat. Yet the French army made the whole of Europe tremble by its weapons of war, by the bravery of its soldiers, and by the military genius of its leaders. Face to face with the enormous potentials of the Napoleonic troops, the Spaniards, inspired by an unshakable national ardor, rediscovered the famous methods of guerrilla warfare, which 25 years before the American militia had tried out on the English forces. But the natives' guerrilla warfare would be of no value as opposed to other means of violence if it did not form a new element in the worldwide process of competition between trusts and monopolies. All right, so this is halfway through chapter one, so I'm going to stop here and make a separate video for part two. Thanks.